KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today. Today I'm on another honor for me, as I was discussing with my guest right before we got started today. It's always a real treat for me to be able to interview people who influenced my thinking going back several years, and I'm very thrilled today to have on Professor Cass Sunstein from the University of Chicago, who is one of those people. I'm a longtime subscriber to the New Republic, and I have read Cass's work starting there from my days. Going back, I've been subscribing to New Republic since high school, which frightened many of my friends in high school. And indeed, I also mentioned to Cass that with my 7-week-old baby and being advised to basically read words to the baby, that Noah had the benefit of hearing a few pages of Cass's most recent book that we're going to be discussing today, Infotopia. So whether he'll be influenced by Cass's work remains to be seen. Cass is a prolific writer for anyone that's familiar with all manner of legal writing, and also even political analysis as well. Infotopia's subtitle is How Many Minds Produce Knowledge. And in this book, Cass has given us the benefit of his thoughts with respect to everything from Wikipedia to open source to blogging. His study of the area takes a little bit different tack than many of the other books, because he kind of looks at it from the standpoint of what groups and groups of people think and how they think and how they come to decisions. And ultimately, one of the things we're going to be discussing today on Hearsay Culture with Cass is the question of accuracy with respect to information that is published or disseminated by way of the internet. One of the many challenges of the information flow that occurs through our new technology is accuracy, and it's something that indeed forms the basis for the name of this show, Hearsay Culture, the question of being able to determine, based upon the amount of information that comes through, what information is worthy of being given credence, what information is not being worthy of being considered truthful. And in Infotopia, Cass takes an interesting look at various statistical analyses with respect to how groups make decisions and the accuracy of those decisions, and then turns to taking a look at several of the shared forms of technology that have created and allowed for the dissemination of information, from wikis to the concept of open source to blogging. And he has an interesting position with respect to all of them, and in fact we're going to probe blogging in particular, because he has a much more nuanced and perhaps less glowing view of blogging than some of the other people that have looked at blogging and its ability to transmit information. But it does come back to the question of accuracy. Cass needs very little introduction, but for those who aren't familiar with his work, he's the Carl N. Llewellyn Distinguished Service Professor of Jurisprudence at the University of Chicago Law School. And as I mentioned, he's a contributing editor, at the New Republic and the American Prospect, and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times and the Washington Post. He's a recipient of several book prizes. In addition to Infotopia, he wrote Radicals and Robes, Republic.com, Why Societies Need Dissent, Designing Democracy, What Constitutions Do, and I'll look forward at the end of the show to discussing Cass's upcoming book, and I'll allow him to go into that. So without any further introduction, let's go to a very short music break, and when we come back, I'll be thrilled to have on Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School, author of the book Infotopia, How Many Minds Produce Knowledge. If I have done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Cass Sunstein. Cass, are you there?
I am here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here today on Hearsay Culture. Let's jump in with a question that I ask all of the authors on the show, which is basically the background, the title of the book, what it means, and why you chose to write about this topic.
The title of the book is supposed to be ambiguous. So Infotopia is supposed to suggest both a utopian vision of things working really great, and it's also supposed to suggest a possible nightmarish vision. We think of dystopias as well as utopias, and I hope Infotopia has a slight alarming sound as well as a prediction of a great future sound.
Mm-hmm.
And also, utopia means nowhere, so there's a sense of this being a place that doesn't exist yet.
The subtitle, How Many Minds Produce Knowledge, also kind of ties in with that idea. Is the creation of knowledge is something that kind of flows through your work, and I'm curious to know how you view this work and the larger body of work that you've produced over the last number of years.
Sure. The subtitle is also supposed to be a pun. It's supposed to suggest how many minds, how many do you need to produce knowledge, and also how, in what way, do many minds produce knowledge. So it also has an ambiguity. I've been interested for a couple decades now in how collections of people get together and either produce a good democracy or a good university or a good company, or how they can misfire. So this book is, in a way, a culmination of several decades of work on how social interactions among human beings make things go well or badly.
It's a bit of an interdisciplinary work in that sense, and I'm curious. I've had a number of authors on, including, for example, Josh Lerner from Harvard Business School, who's written about the patent system. And here we have a little bit of an opposite situation where we have someone trained in the law writing about non-law areas. So I'm curious to ask you whether that was a challenge to look at these analyses of statistical methods and what have you with respect to taking a look at this issue.
It was a definite challenge. Trained as a lawyer and that reading Supreme Court opinions and lower court opinions, that's basically what I do and feel most comfortable with. But I got a lot of help. There are a lot of people throughout the country who were willing to assist me, both in co-authoring papers on group deliberation and in trying to handle some statistical analysis.
Did you find, as a personal side, did you enjoy going through that process? It's always exciting to be learning and focusing on something different in one's career, and I'm curious how you felt as you were going through this material.
Oh, it was fabulous. I've had co-authors on this, including Danny Kahneman, a Nobel Prize winner, long at Berkeley, works on human cognition, and Richard Thaler, an economist now at the University of Chicago, who works on how human behavior departs from what economists typically think. And to work with people in different fields is exhilarating. I hope this book, too, is founded in law and shows an emphasis on legal problems. But it was exhilarating, really, to deal with other people in different fields.
What is, for the benefit of the listeners, to cut to really the thesis of the book before we dig into it, what would you describe as the thesis of your study in Infotopia?
There are two, really. The first is that a lot of times when human beings interact with each other, things can go really terribly wrong, that we can end up going to extremes. The terrorist behavior is a product sometimes of human information exchange, that the disaster at Enron is a similar disaster, that political correctness on college campuses can be a function of bad information exchange, that when the Catholic Church covered up sexual abuses, that was a result of bad information aggregation. So that is the dark side of human interactions on the Internet and elsewhere. But there's also a much more optimistic side, which I suggest is reflected most obviously actually in prediction markets, which are flourishing on the Internet, by which collections of people actually bet on the outcome of events. And prediction markets used at Google, among other companies, Microsoft too, have been extremely successful. So the book is really about how information exchange can lead to some of the worst disasters in human history and also lead to phenomenal economic and political success.
How much of your book ultimately is focused on the technology itself? In other words, we for a long time it's been considered, as you go through, indeed you discuss in the book, the issue of how knowledge is created and disseminated. How much of your focus in this particular book is squarely, and the conclusions that you reach, squarely based upon the technologies that have developed in the last few years?
I'd say about 50%. Mm-hmm. That there's a significant discussion of wikis, which are made possible by new technologies, of blogs, of open source software, of prediction markets, and those are all technologically based discussions. On the other hand, human beings are not fundamentally different from what they were 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago, Aristotle and James Madison, separated by great length of time themselves, and both great length of times before us, were on to many of these same problems. So some of the dark side of human deliberation and how social interactions lead to extremism and error, that happens on the Internet, but a lot of the discussions in the book are based on material that precedes new technologies. So my eye is constantly on the Internet in thinking about these processes, because that's where the present and even more the future lie. But we can learn a lot from work that was done even in the 1980s and 1970s.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, I often have, I've had several guests on who, where we've discussed the fact simply that oftentimes, as especially technologists and especially people in the younger age range, think that all problems are new. And indeed, many of the problems that exist both with respect to technology but also generally in terms of user interface and things like that are issues that have been discussed and kicked around in previous generations, and indeed we can learn from them, and so it's nice to have that perspective. You come down, I'll let you describe how you come down in terms of weighing what you know, the dark side and the more optimistic side. You come out on the optimistic side, and maybe for the benefit again of the listeners, to cut to your conclusion, why is it that ultimately you're optimistic about where we're headed?
Okay. We have this new tool by which, if we want to know how good a restaurant is or a hotel is or a doctor is, we can aggregate the information that diverse human beings have very easily. So the optimism really can be traced to one of the great ideas of the 20th century, and that is the economist Hayek, H-A-Y-E-K, his idea that information in society is widely dispersed. Each of us has a little bit. If we can get all the little bits together, then we'll really know a lot. Hayek said that in the context of the price system, arguing that the reason socialist planning will fail is that even if the planners are well motivated and extremely intelligent and super knowledgeable, they can't just know as much as a price will, because a price will reflect the aggregation of knowledge from thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of human beings. So what I think we are seeing now is the capacity to enlist Hayek's insight in so many domains, some of which do use the price system, and some of which just aggregate information in rating systems, like for movies, or on wikis, where you get the dispersed information there. Mm-hmm. So the idea is the reason for the optimism is the technology is making available information aggregation and collective intelligence in a way that really goes way beyond anything in the history of humanity. On the other hand, I'm less interested really in trying to figure out whether we should be smiling about the future or scowling about the future, mm-hmm. figuring about how we can enlist what we know about how information can be aggregated well or poorly to ensure that it's aggregated well rather than poorly. So the failure of information aggregation at the Central Intelligence Agency with respect to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that had real consequences, and there are ways to make sure that that is less likely to happen in the future. Many American companies in California and elsewhere are doing badly because they're not taking advantage of the information that actually the company has within it. So the question, I think, is less whether we should be feel upbeat or negative about the future. If we have to choose, let's choose to be upbeat, no question about that. But how we can avoid the problems of bad information aggregation and get the successes that some companies are profiting from.
I do want to come back to that. The idea of open innovation is something that the term coined by Henry Chesbrough at Berkeley, and it's something that we've discussed on the show, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. I do want to start off with that background to take a look at some of the concerns that you have with respect to how information is disseminated and indeed how decisions are made on the Internet. And those are issues like groupthink and echo chambers and others that I'll ask you to define, and we can discuss in a little detail. But one last question about the overall thrust of the book. There is, as you know, a growing body of literature with respect to the idea of social sharing, the idea that came, that was most thoroughly developed in Yochai Benckler's recent book, The Wealth of Networks. And I'm curious to get your reaction to one potential conclusion with respect to the thrust of your book, which is you're less than completely optimistic, I'll put it that way, view of the idea of social sharing and indeed accuracy. Is it fair, or how would you respond to the statement that your book is in one way or another an attack or a questioning of the social sharing model?
I think that's entirely fair that Benckler, whose book is extremely good, it's really terrific, he and others downplay the way that social sharing can produce a kind of balkanized nation and also lead some groups to terrible blunders. So if you have a group of people who are really excited about taking some risk, let's say, whether it's entering into a new venture for a company or a university starting a new program or a nation trying to have some new economic or military initiative, the risk is, even if there's a ton of social sharing, that the people in the group will spur one another mm-hmm. toward a more extreme version of what they thought before they started to talk. And that kind of spurring toward more extremism is a pretty close to an iron law of human interaction, and social sharing often fails to overcome the problem. It actually is the source of the problem. So what I do think a bit about some of the excitement about social networks and social sharing is that it's naive and starry-eyed and not based on an adequate understanding of what human interactions actually do. In fact, one thing we could say about social sharing as we're witnessing the enthusiasm for it is itself an exemplification of the very phenomenon to which it's insufficiently alert, mm-hmm. where the phenomenon is that like-minded people get more and more excited about their tendencies. Mm-hmm. So if you get a group of people who are talking about climate change and they think it's a non-problem, as they talk to one another, they'll get more clear that it's a non-problem. So if you get a group of people who are excited about social sharing, they will spur one another to increased enthusiasm and insensitivity to some of the downsides and risks. So the phenomenon that my book is actually focusing on, in large part, the downside of social sharing, is something that the enthusiasts for social sharing don't see because they're talking too much to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's. I want to come back to that, and I kind of do want to come back as a follow-up question later with respect to the enthusiasm being for the technology itself or for the conclusions which the technology engenders. But I think in order to develop this idea and to probe your book, we should talk about some of the concerns you have. One of the concerns you raise is the concept of the information cocoon. And for the benefit of the listeners who aren't familiar, I'd ask you to define what that term means with the follow-up question of considering or thinking about and what people are actually doing on the Internet in the first place.
An information cocoon is just a little universe in which people restrict themselves to either topics or points of view that they like. So many people are creating information cocoons in which they only hear about a certain political point of view, or they only hear about certain issues of concern, or only hear a certain view of technology. Mm-hmm. So because life is short, all of us in some domains are in an information cocoon. With respect to baseball, I myself focus mostly on the Chicago White Sox and Chicago Cubs.
And I won't hold that against you as a Yankee fan, by the way.
So my cocoon extends a little bit to the Yankees, but not so much to the Dodgers. And so we all are cocooned a little bit. The risk is that with the new technologies, many people will restrict themselves really to points of view that they agree with before they started to read. And what we know is that a lot of people are using the Internet to expand their horizons, and that's the kind of best feature of the Internet, in my opinion, that people can see lots of stuff outside what used to be a cocoon. So we know that that's happening a lot, but we also know enough to know, at least in the political domain, and surely it's true in domains of culture and others, that people do cocoon themselves in the sense that they spend most of their time on topics and points of view that they like, and more echo chamber type existence than we would observe if people are reading through the daily newspaper. At least that's happening for many people that we know.
In your view, is the technology merely an extension of what people would do anyway in the absence of the ability to use the Internet to create these groups? In other words, if there's an academic conference, oftentimes conferences and the invitees reflect a certain viewpoint. And it is oftentimes, it certainly, I think, oftentimes is the case that, especially with respect to topics that have a certain political bent to them, as that you do find a lot of the same people talking to each other. In the absence of the technology, do you think that those kinds of behaviors that have existed for decades, for, you know, you probably could say for as long as humans have been around, they've tended to want to be around people that are like them. Do you think the technology exacerbates that issue? Does it change it in light of your, you know, reflection with respect to the ability to access different viewpoints? How do you feel that those previous human behaviors are extended or amplified on the Internet?
I think in a way the Internet makes the problem of information cocoons smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy for people to find stuff that's different from their little community.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a very good email a while back from a citizen of Utah who had heard or read something that I'd said, and her response was, the Internet really has saved me. It's really broadened my horizons tremendously. I now see points of view and topics that my community just didn't offer. So the technology is not neutral in that sense. It's a big gain in terms of my concern. On the other hand, for many people, there's the following potential, which is you can read, spend your whole day or your non-working day just reading stuff that amplifies your previous conviction and stirs you to a greater sense of outrage and incredulity that your fellow citizens could be so bad, or your government, or some part of your government could be so evil. And so what the technology does in this way is it both allows people much more room to broaden their horizons, and also allows people, if they want, to restrict themselves into communities of like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want to say that human nature is in any way different. That would be preposterous. But I would want to say that the technology does change our capacity both to expand and to narrow ourselves. And we know that different people are using it in different ways.
The ability of people to make these group decisions is something that you focus heavily on, and you're obviously concerned with respect to the accuracy of those decisions. In developing that idea and studying that issue, you discuss the Condorcet jury theorem. And again, for people that are familiar with statistics and or if you've taken, you know, courses in behavioral science or microeconomics, things like that, they might be familiar. But for those that aren't, could you describe what that is and then also talk about why you focus so heavily on it in the book?
Yeah, the Condorcet jury theorem has a bad name. Needs a snappier name. Everyone should know it.
I was going to say jury theorem, but I thought, no, I should label it a little bit.
Condorcet's theorem. Yeah. Okay, the idea is simple. If you have a group of people, each of whom is more than 50% likely to be right, the likelihood that the majority of the group will be right increases to 100% as the size of the group gets bigger. And here's the way of making the theorem, I think, intuitive. Imagine I have a coin that I'm flipping, and it's weighted, so it's going to come up heads 55% of the time. The more often I flip it, the more likely it is that it's going to come up heads more often than tails, because it's weighted to be heads most of the time. And if you think of people as like the coin, if they're weighted to be right, if you have a large group, it's just pretty definitely going to be right, because everyone in it is more than 50% likely to be right. This helps to explain why on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the audience usually does really well, because each member is more than 50% likely to be right. Or there are enough members who are more than 50% likely to be right that they'll drive the outcome, because the other people will just be random and be distributed around the four answers. So the Condorcet-Drury theorem basically says if you get a million people of whom each one is more than 50% likely to be right, and you ask them some question, the likelihood that the majority of the million will be right is really, really high. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm excited about this because it helps explain why sometimes crowds are very wise. It gives a little arithmetic, and not very fancy arithmetic, to the idea that if you ask a bunch of people, experts or non-experts, some question where they have some reason to know what the answer is, if you ask enough of them, majority is going to get it right. So I think the Condorcet-Drury theorem helps explain a ton about why free markets work and about why democracies work. It's kind of it's very fundamental. On the other hand, there's a problem with group decision making, which is if you get a group of people together, most of whom are less likely than 50% likely to be right. I did this at the University of Chicago, asking about the weight of the space shuttle. The average answer, the majority answer, they were way off because people didn't have any information. And so if people don't know, then they'll get it wrong. And more disturbing still, often deliberating groups, small ones or large ones, blunder, because they just end up thinking what the majority thinks, even if some people within the group know what's right. Mm-hmm. So majorities often are very powerful in group decision making, even if there are individuals within the group who are more accurate than majorities. So some people are very happy about the prospect that a deliberating group is just going to figure out what's true. Unfortunately, it's not so often at the Central Intelligence Agency or the White House or the Democratic Party or the Catholic Church or the local labor union. The deliberation won't go so great because the group won't do well enough to elicit the information the individual people have.
It's a good place to take a short break, because when we come back, I think you develop what you identify as four big problems, quote unquote, of deliberating groups, and I want to dig into a few of them. And we started discussing them briefly with information cocoons. And so after the short music break, we will continue the conversation on hearsay culture with Professor Cass Sunstein, author of the book Infotopia: How Many Minds Produce Knowledge. Cutting short Jay McShann is probably a crime, but I'm doing it again because we need to get back to the conversation here on Hearsay Cultures, and the conversation with Professor Cass Sunstein, author of the book Infotopia. Before I do that, however, it's the time where I'm going to ask you for money. KZSU is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station here at Stanford University, and it requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making such a donation or even learning more, you can do a couple of things. A, you can go to the KZSU webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. You can find it at kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope you continue to keep listening to KZSU. So we're back with Cass Sunstein. And Cass, before the music break, I was discussing your four big problems that you identify in your book. Perhaps you could explain what they are for the listeners.
The first we've already touched on, which is group polarization. The idea here is that deliberating groups usually end up in a more extreme position, one that's in line with what they thought before they started to talk. So if you have a group of people who think that the Iraq war is going well, there aren't many left, but maybe there are some who think the Iraq war is going well, as they talk with one another, they'll end up thinking a more extreme version of that. If you have a group of people who think that Senator Clinton would be a great president, as they talk to one another, they'll typically end up in a more extreme version of that. We have a ton of data now showing that the tendency toward a more extreme version of the original tendency, of the original view, is a robust phenomenon. This mm-hmm. is what happens with deliberating groups. That's number one, group polarization. Number two is amplification of mistakes. So if you have a group that tends toward an error, much of the time the deliberating group will end up not just perpetuating the mistake, but thinking, but amplifying it. So if a group of people who are willing to show in the jury room, let's say, a degree of racial prejudice against African Americans, let's just say that that's a mistake given how the law is, they will amplify their own mistake as a result of group deliberation. So mistakes tend not to be cured much of the time in deliberating groups, not merely maintained, but actually amplified. That's the second. The third is my favorite of the four, and this is called hidden profiles. Mm-hmm. And here the basic idea is, if you have a deliberating group in which every member has certain information, but just a few members of the group have information that is unique to them, what typically happens is that the information that is unique to the people who are isolated in their knowledge will have very little effect on the group's decision most of the time, and the information that's shared by the group members will have a dominant effect on the group's decision. So if you're a group of people in a company thinking that some initiative is probably a good idea and they have information suggesting that it's a good idea, but a couple of people in the company know that that's a mistake, they have some reasons for caution that the initiative will go sour, their own information is typically discounted in the group. It remains a hidden profile. And many groups in government, in universities, in the corporate sector, labor unions, the decisions go wrong because the hidden profile never gets out. Mm-hmm. So we have group polarization, we have amplification of errors, we have hidden profiles, and the fourth, which is the funniest of the four, is the cascade effect. Mm-hmm. And here's how a cascade effect works. A says something about, let's say, an actor or a policy or technological development. B, the second person who doesn't really know, believes A because he doesn't know. Now you have A and B who think something about, let's say, an actor. Let's say the actor's personal life. Then there's someone called C who learns that A and B both think that thing about the actor's personal life. And C, who we're supposing is ignorant, will think if A and B think it, then it's probably true. And now we have a little group of people, A, B, and C, who all believe something about an actor's personal life, or it could be the government, or it could be technology. And then the D's of the world will have to have a lot of private information to reject the shared view of A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. So the way cascades work is that you can get a lot of apparent informational signal from a shared view of hundreds, thousands, millions of people when it's just a few early movers who suggested the view. So if you ask people in certain countries what produced the September 11th attack, they'll say, well, it was Israel or the United States was attacking itself. And this isn't necessarily because they are full of hatred. It's just because they're responding to the information they hear from others who are themselves in a cascade.
Mm-hmm. Of the four that you identify, which one do you see as the biggest, as having the most detrimental effect on the viability of the Internet as an accurate source of information?
I would say it's group polarization mm-hmm. is the most serious problem, which is, I think, a better way to think of it than groupthink, which is a better phrase, but which is vague. We don't know what the hypothesis is. The group polarization idea is that people end up in a more extreme point in line with what they thought before they started to talk with one another. Mm-hmm. And that we are seeing on the Internet every day.
Let's dive in the remaining about 15 minutes that we have left to talk specifically about a couple of scenarios that you raise in the book. And you talk a bit about free software. And in fact, you mentioned in your book, which I would be doing a complete detriment to the listeners if I didn't ask about this, that in fact, you in college shared a dorm with Richard Stallman?
I was in the same dorm with Richard Stallman and with Bill Gates. I don't remember if Bill Gates lived there, but I remember him playing pinball there. I remember Richard Stallman very well. Yeah.
And to the extent that I ask it this way, did you ever see interaction between Gates and Stallman?
Not that I remember.
And you mentioned in the book that Richard Stallman was even at that point, or correct me if I'm wrong, what was he known for at that point? Was he a computer guy even at that point, and someone that was identified as someone who was going to do some interesting work in this area?
I wouldn't say we thought he was going to do interesting work. We thought he was extremely smart.
Uh-huh.
So what I remember about him was he was a computer whiz, and this was in the early 70s when the idea that the world was going to look like it turned out to look, no one thought that. So it seemed as if he was interested in something unusual to be interested in. So mm-hmm. There are a lot of people in college that like that.
Right.
And it seemed like he was extremely smart. He was also eccentric, I would say, in the sense that kind of offbeat, though there was a human sweetness, I thought, underneath the fixation on computers and the lack of, let's say, the kind of polish and ease that some Harvard students show even at a young age.
Mm-hmm. And obviously time has shown that he's had an enormous influence on technology, and particularly how it's created. And in that vein, I want to ask you about the dichotomy between open source and free software. As any listener who's familiar with these issues and focuses on technology knows, the open source idea doesn't eschew the concept of commercialization. You can have an open source piece of software or piece of code that is yet sold in commerce, whereas free software, for which Richard Stallman is particularly known, is indeed the idea that it is not sold in commerce, putting it simply. And I'm curious to know, with respect to these issues, do you think, or what do you think will happen to these forms of use of software as more and more collaboration is affected by the Internet?
Okay, I'd say one point, which is that Stallman likes the word free rather than open source,
mm-hmm.
Not mostly because of substance, mostly because of rhetoric. So he says that free means unfettered.
Mm-hmm.
So he likes that better than open source. He's written because it connects liberty, which is what he really thinks it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the future, I think there isn't anything simple to say here, and here's why. What is best suited to produce innovation? We don't know yet, and it really will depend probably on the context. So if you had complete freedom with respect to some technologies, in the sense that once they're available, they're given away and people don't pay for them, then you'd see less in the way of innovation. So the profit motive remains, even in the Internet age, sometimes a very important spur to innovation. Think, for example, of energy sources. If we had free energy sources, we'd probably have less innovation with respect to cleaner burning technologies than we now have. So I think that whether we'll have open source software, which has a commercial feature to it, though there's also openness to it once it's sold, whether we have free software in the sense of the stuff that's completely given away, or whether we'll have proprietary software of the Microsoft sort, the jury is still out on what will work best. I share, under Stallman's influence, a degree of excitement about the potential for innovation when lots and lots of people are participating and making improvements, some of whom don't have an economic incentive. That Hayek's old model of dispersed information and creativity, though the model doesn't, as applied to here, doesn't necessarily have a profit motive in it. So I share the excitement about that. But I do think it's premature to project that we're coming to a free or open source society. So with respect to medicines, there's a lot of enthusiasm for open source biotechnology, which may be very helpful for people, especially in poor countries. But the pharmaceutical companies, unpopular as they sometimes are, produce a lot of good for a lot of people, and one reason they do that is there are a lot of dollars to be gained.
Yeah, and I guess which begs the question, because another thing you do discuss in the book is taking a patent law as an aside with respect to open source, and I guess I pose the same question to you. As people know, with respect to intellectual property law, its undergirding is the idea of incentivizing innovation. Do you see open source, as compared to, say, patent law, as having the potential, at least, for undermining the incentivization basis for intellectual property law?
I do, in a way that may well be good. So my friend and former colleague Larry Lessig has done very influential work on how copyright law in particular, that's an interest of his, but similar analysis would apply to patents, sometimes actually undermine innovation because they lock things up. And copyright law surely is to some extent locking things up more than is necessary for innovation. And the same is probably true of patent law. But as I say, I think the celebrators of open source and free methods should be alert to the fact that human beings, some of us, some of the time, do more and better if we can have some economic gain. So I wouldn't want to predict that patent law and copyright law are on the way out. And in a way, I think the best solution here really is a market solution. To some extent, we're witnessing it, in which we watch competition between open source software and proprietary software, for example, or competition between copyrighted and not at all copyrighted or copylefted systems, and see which works better.
Do you see the enthusiasm? I mentioned this before the break, and I'll come back to it now quickly. Do you see the enthusiasm for social sharing as an enthusiasm for the technology affecting the ability for more information to be disseminated? Or do you think that, in fact, it's greater than that, and the enthusiasm stems from the idea that there will be better decisions?
Both. Some people think that if we share information, we'll end up knowing things which will enable us to make progress where we otherwise wouldn't. And there's no question that that has been true in many domains. So Wikipedia is a great example of social sharing, where there's this phenomenal resource available, which is generally good and accurate. On the other hand, I do think you're right, and it's quite important that some of the enthusiasm for social sharing and collaborative production isn't necessarily that the products are so good, it's that the process is so open and communal. And even in a capitalist society, people love that. So to be able to make connections with strangers and produce great things across large distances, or even pretty good things across large distances, can be thrilling, even if what's produced isn't as fabulous as some other things people are producing through some different production method.
Yeah, I should confess that a particular interest of mine is generally the idea of technology allowing for greater transparency in public decision-making processes. And in fact, my most recent article focused on trade secrecy impeding those decisions with respect to public infrastructure. So I definitely have an interest in it, and my interest is logistical as much as it is the question of whether ultimately the decisions will be better. I generally agree with your conclusion that the jury's still out on that. I do want to ask you in our last few minutes about your view on blogging, because you do take a bit of a different perspective on that than a lot of the people looking at it. So if you could summarize your view on blogging in a couple minutes, that would be terrific.
Yeah, there are a couple very good sides about blogging. One is that it helps break something close to a monopoly of the mass media so that we can correct their judgments and they consult bloggers and sometimes find out that they were headed in the wrong direction or there's some new direction that's really good. So it does allow dispersed information to get to the public, so that's very helpful. Also, it's the case that if you want to consult lots of different points of view on public issues or entertainment or culture, blogging increases the options, so that's a very good thing. What concerns me about blogging is that it increases for many people the echo chamber effect. So often people are using the blogosphere so as to create information cocoons in which they basically listen and read only the things that they agreed with before, and they just get extremely stirred up so that they end up thinking of their fellow citizens as enemies in some sort of war sometimes rather than as fellow citizens who have a different point of view from which they can learn something. We do know from empirical studies that cross-linking is the exception rather than the rule. People typically link to people with whom they agree. That's the usual pattern. And we also know that often when there's a reference to an opposing point of view, it's not to say, here's an alternative position, but to say, look how contemptuous and ridiculous and evil the other side is. So the blogosphere, seems to me, is not wonderful in the way that the price system is, nor is it wonderful in the way that prediction markets on the Internet have been. Mm-hmm. It does contain a lot of information, and that's helpful in a democracy, needless to say, but it can also disturb democracy by getting people just unjustly stirred up by hearing agitated and louder versions of what they thought before.
Do you see the, with respect to blogging, the stratification within blogs between the what I'll call the MySpace type blog, where people are sharing information about what they had for breakfast or their favorite band or what have you, versus the news aggregator users who are more likely, in my opinion, to be people that are going to look to the internet to gain knowledge about specific areas where a proper decision or the right decision, quote unquote, has more effect? Do your conclusions diverge with respect to how people use the internet or to what they or for what they seek when they go to a blog?
I'm focusing really on the political blogs, mm-hmm. So the ones where people discuss issues that bear on democratic self-government. Mm-hmm. So blogs where people just talk about their day and what they like, those are like diaries, mm-hmm. And diaries have the virtues and vices of diaries, and if people want to read other people's diaries, and everyone's okay with that, welcome to freedom. Mm-hmm. That's fine. What concerns me a bit more is the celebration of the blogosphere, which seems to me, on balance, a good thing, not a bad thing, but which has a definite downside.
With that note, you are working on your next project, and for the benefit of the listeners, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
I'm finishing now Republic.com 2.0. A few years ago, I published a little book called Republic.com, which was written the first draft in 9 days, and maybe the book suffers for that fact. It is a warning about personalized internet use. Now I've had a few years to think about it. Republic.com 2.0 offers a more ambivalent and not as negative conception of the political spaces on the internet. The subtitle of the book is Revenge of the Blogs, which was given to me by my publisher. I think it's a Star Wars reference. And Republic.com 3.0, we have to think who's going to be returning.
Right. Well, I look forward. And when is that book scheduled to be on the shelves?
Should be on the shelves in August or September.
Terrific. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And perhaps I will invite you back to discuss that work.
It would be a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cass, for being here on Hearsay Culture, for taking the time.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank Cass Sunstein for being on today, discussing his book, Infotopia, How Many Minds Produce Knowledge. And indeed, I want to thank all of the guests that I have on for discussing their works. The goal of Hearsay Culture ultimately is to educate and to allow for this information to be discussed in a wide audience. And so I'm excited to have had Cass on, and I'm looking forward to my upcoming guests in the next few weeks. Next week, we're going to be talking to Professor Bob Markley from Indiana, who wrote a book about 10 years ago called Virtual Realities and Their Discontents. And not surprisingly, given how virtual realities have developed, it's still quite a relevant book. And so I'm looking forward to talking to Bob and kind of getting his perspective on where things are 10 years after he wrote his book. After that, I'm going to have a run of live shows on KZSU. This show is actually being recorded on March 26th. But starting in mid-April, I'll be interviewing people live from 5 to 6 on Wednesdays, and I'm looking forward to starting that run with Fred von Lohmann, who's a senior intellectual property lawyer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Fred has been in the forefront of a number of very high-profile cases involving challenges of technology law, and I'm looking forward to having Fred on to discuss his work and kind of get his perspective on where we are. And then after that, there's going to be a number of other live guests right through May. I should mention that KZSU has generously offered, and I have accepted, to continue doing the show after I leave Stanford University. It has been mentioned on previous shows. I have accepted a position as a full-time tenure-track professor at Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. However, having said that, I am committed to doing the show, and I want to do the show, and I really have enormous regard for KZSU in giving me the opportunity to do a show like this. And because I want to continue doing the show will continue even in my absence. I will stay affiliated with Stanford in other ways, which I'll discuss in the future, but suffice to say, Hearsay Culture will continue on KZSU even after I have moved across the country. And I will have more information with regard to that as the day approaches. So you can look for more schedule information with respect to Hearsay Culture by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule, and you can see our guests coming up. Additionally, as always, you can find this show by podcast without the music by going either to a number of options. One is the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society. If you type Center for Internet and Society in iTunes, you will find Hearsay Culture. You can also find the podcast feed on cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is CIS's webpage. And of course, you can also get the audio on the hearsayculture.com website. As always, I ask listeners, if you have any comments or suggestions with respect to the show, to email me. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. So thank you again for listening to KZSU. Please stay tuned for more programming on the station, and I look forward to talking to you next week.